This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast for June 7th. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome, Jackie. We have so much on this list that I don't even know where to start, but we're going to start with all sorts of news that's coming at us in terms of the Canadian situation, the politics, and so on. And then we're going to spend the latter half of the podcast just talking about the oil price. We've seen some substantial weakness.
Yeah, surprising fall in oil price went from $65 a few weeks ago, WTI, to 50 now, or just above 50.
Yeah, that's pretty dramatic, and we need to understand that as we go forward. But we have so much news to talk about. We've got the whole thing with the Senate, with C-48, C-69, the two bills, the first one, the C-48 on the tanker ban, the C-69 on the new Canadian energy regulator, et cetera. So where do you want to start?
Well, we just learned yesterday that the Senate is going to reject its own committee's decision to cancel C-48. So, you know, there's a subcommittee of the Senate that made a decision that they wanted to just kill the bill.
Yeah.
But then it went to the broader Senate for a vote.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to claim that I fully understand all this Robert's Rules of Order and the governmental procedures. But here's the basic situation. So C-48 is the tanker ban, the ban that says that there can be no tankers, basically for bitumen, shipping off the west coast of British Columbia, which effectively landlocks bitumen from the west coast for Alberta crude. Very contentious issue. I testified saying, you know, this is a really divisive piece of legislation. The Senate's really been actually active and doing their job in terms of being a sober second thought on this whole thing. I mean, but the subcommittee effectively came out and said that we cannot have this kind of tanker ban because of a whole variety of reasons, the landlocking of Alberta being one of them. And that the Senate then last night, as you said, voted and said, nope, we're going to basically uphold this thing. We're going to have to debate it further, amend it, and send it down to the House of Commons.
Okay, so we're going to keep the tanker ban, but there may be some amendments proposed now, so we'll have to wait and see how that plays out. Now, when you testified, you had some great ideas for amendments. What were a couple of those?
Well, I think the amendments were, one, the idea of a corridor. In other words, okay, you know, ban it along the coast, but allow it through Prince Rupert, right? And then that's not unique. Other people have been saying that as well, and I think that that's probably the best amendment that could be put forward. Other amendments would be, well, listen, I mean, along a similar vein, when Enbridge Gateway was approved by the National Energy Board, they gave 209 recommendations and said, well, you know, why don't you listen to those recommendations and implement some of those? They had a lot of marine safety type recommendations and conditions imposed on that. So, like,
so you're basically saying, like, make those amendments associated with other, like, all tanker movements in. But you had you also had another one, which is, why don't we just ban tanker movements across all of our coasts? Why would you just say that this one particular part of the country is more ecologically sensitive than others?
Yeah. I mean, I sort of pointed to the whole carbon elitism of thinking that only one coastline in Canada out of its multitude, from the Arctic to the Strait of Belle Isle in the east, all the way down to the Gulf of St. Lawrence, it's all environmentally sensitive in the context of tankers. So if you do it for one area, you got to do it for everywhere.
Right. If you don't think you can do it safely, then why do you think you can do it somewhere else?
But nobody's going to do that. But I, you know, sort of just to highlight the issue. So anyway, I think this is going to be interesting. We just need to get away from this black and white binary yes or no, ban or no ban, and come to some sort of sense with the thing, or just kill the whole thing. And then there's the more important C-69.
So C-69, which is basically amending the process for approving major infrastructure projects, including mining, pipelines, and large oil sands projects. So what's the update on that?
Well, the update is that it did passed through the Senate with recommendations. There's 180 recommendations that have been put forth. So now it goes back down to the House of Commons. And again, I'm not an expert on parliamentary procedure, but the House of Commons will then consider which of the 180 to agree to and then pass the legislation. I don't know exactly what all 180 recommendations are. There are a couple that are important, though, one of which is that the Minister of Environment doesn't have as much sway once a decision's been taken. That's really important because it depoliticizes the whole regulatory process, which was a really, I think, an important thing to consider. That's one of them. There was a few others that are important.
Yeah, focuses more on some economic issues where that was maybe not as emphasized as many people thought it should have. There's also a belief that some of these amendments make it less susceptible to legal challenges.
Yeah.
I do want to just say that, you know, from my perspective, I remember even 5-6 years ago thinking, you know, there was discussion in Canada, do we need this Senate? It's costing us a lot of money. Do they actually do anything? So yeah. I have been pretty impressed with you know, the activity that I've seen on both of these very important bills. They've heard from people across the country. They're making suggestions for changes. I no longer see them as a rubber stamp organization that I maybe thought of them 5 years ago.
Yeah, I think they're doing their job. I mean, there's no question there's partisanship and there's to-ing and fro-ing and so on. But I think, you know, these are very consequential bills and they did need that proverbial sober second thought of the Senate.
Yeah. I want to talk about Enbridge Line 3 here. This week we learned, even though it had an existing approval and it was planned to start up in the second half of 2020, which was already delayed because of issues with getting permits from the various organizations in the United States, but a Minnesota court decided that this already approved environmental impact statement is not complete. It did not cover the potential for spill analysis in the Lake Superior as well as the St. Louis River the way it should have. Now, is this familiar here?
This is just ongoing. I mean, we have a very litigious approach to regulatory approvals now.
Well, you know, I think the opponents to the oil sands industry in particular have found a bit of a weak spot here. Like the TMX had an approval, but court ruled that more scope was needed, so that approval was canceled. Keystone XL had an approval, but a Montana court found that parts of the environmental review were out of date and did not cover everything that needed to be covered. And it also has been delayed. And so I think this is the way of the future. So these bills like C-69 have to be thinking about that's the new environment and they have to be thought about in a way that makes them less open to these legal challenges, although I think that is the way of the future.
Well, it is the way of the future. It's not only oil and gas. It's any major infrastructure project that has any environmental footprint, which is basically every single capital project, whether it's mining or whether it's electrical towers for transmission or whatever.
Yeah.
Like it's just, you know, if we enter into this world where everything is challenged in the courts, it just drags out forever and then investors just go away, so you get nothing done.
Yeah. Well, and the interesting thing, it's not just Canada that has this issue. This is happening in the U.S. Their system is the same. So far Enbridge has not made any adjustment to their timeline. So we'll wait and see. But I would think there potentially could be some change here. They have to study this. It may take some time. There may be some additional requirements. If you look at the situation for TMX, that happened in August. And the project almost will be delayed a year because we're expecting on June 18th that we may learn that the project gets the go-ahead again. But that was almost a year delay because of that court decision.
Yeah, no, I know. I mean, you listen to this conversation, right? We have not mentioned one single number. I mean, Jackie, you and I have been trained as analysts, economists, and we deal with numbers to try and make historically sense of whether or not projects make sense in terms of making money. Now, the analysis that, as the analytic world that we have migrated into is trying to understand government and the legal system, stuff that we have not really been trained for and are learning as we go. And I think that really says something about investment in these sorts of projects, because when you get into the legal realm and you get into the political realm, you can't attach numbers easily to the risk to be able to quantify. And so it becomes very subjective, very uncertain. And the tendency is, well, I don't know. So therefore, I'm out of here.
Mm-hmm. But there are real implications that we can put the numbers on, because we know that there's a lot of supply still coming from the oil sands, more than that we have takeaway.
Yep.
And so this line three being delayed is impactful. If it is delayed, it will mean more rail needed, and we can calculate how much that will be. So
You can definitely put numbers on the consequences. You can't put numbers on the issues leading up to the consequences.
Yeah, yeah. And the timelines. And that's what we're learning. Yeah. You know, eventually these projects probably, I expect, will be built, but it's harder and harder to predict the time. Yeah. Now, talking about investments in Western Canada, we do have some new investments here in Western Canada, CNRL purchasing Devon oil sands assets. So there is some money for buying Canadian oil assets. So CNRL purchased for $2.8 billion, around 70 to 80,000 barrels a day of bitumen from Devon, as well as some of Devon's other assets. But the primary asset was this Jackfish project, phase one and two. And there also had some future oil sands projects that are part of that as well. Now, this is not the first time a foreign has exited from Canada recently. We know we've seen Statoil, Total, ConocoPhillips, Marathon, Royal Dutch Shell last year, Apache. So, you know, maybe
The list goes on.
Yeah. So this could be viewed as negative, you know, another company that's sort of selling out of Canada.
Yeah.
But I think there's a positive side to
this.
Yeah,
there is a positive. I mean, just for our listeners, Devon is a large American independent oil and gas producer. I don't know how it ranks, but it's pretty darn big. And CNRL purchased their Canadian assets, as you said. So I actually think there are positives to this thing, quite positive, in that what we're seeing is a repatriation of the Canadian oil and gas industry into Canadian. CNRL is a Calgary-based Canadian oil and gas company that's now the largest oil and gas company in the land.
Yeah. And, you know, the money that Devon would have generated, the cash flow, primarily would have flowed out of this country. But with CNRL acquiring the assets, so far they've been investing mostly in Canada.
Yeah.
That cash flow, you know, part of it will definitely go to their shareholders.
Right.
But part of it will also go potentially to more capital investments here in Western Canada than would have been the case if Devon was the owner.
Yeah, because we are in a new era where, okay, the prior era was that we had a lot of foreign investment, whether it came from American or European or Asian interests. The money came in to help our industry grow. The cash flow that was generated from the projects that they invested in was reinvested back into the ground, right? It was always reinvested back in Canada. But now we're in an era where we're not growing anymore, right? In fact, we're having to curtail. Mm-hmm. But we're still generating the cash flow. And the question is, where does that cash flow go? In the case of foreign controlled interests, the cash flow basically gets siphoned out of the country and invested in some other part of the world. So, you know, take the ConocoPhillips example, multinational, it would take the cash flow that they realized out of the oil sands and who knows, stick it somewhere in Africa or
probably the Permian.
That's
where they're really growing.
Yeah. That, you know, put it here. Yeah. So, you know, that is not a desirable situation. You want the money that is generated in Canada off of our resources to stay in Canada. Mm-hmm. And CNRL is a Canadian company that is consolidating and I think making the industry more Canadian. Now, what they do with the surplus cash flow and the surplus cash flow from the other oil sands operators, that's the $20 billion question, because this year, you know, despite the weakening prices here, you know, the cash flow generated by the Canadian oil and gas industry will be over $50 billion. But at the moment, we can only account for 31-ish being spent. That's a $20 billion gap that we need to hear from these companies in terms of what they're going to do.
Yeah. And most of that gap, most of that $20 billion of extra cash flow is coming out of the oil sands companies.
Right.
I do want to clarify on ConocoPhillips, by the way. They exited part of their investments in Canada, but they still have their oil sands investments. So I guess they haven't totally exited.
Yeah.
But you're right. Those conventional assets that they sold to Cenovus, today that cash flow is coming into Canadian operations, where before it was going to the Permian.
Right. So as long as we are now in sort of consolidation mode and so on, it's better to see it in Canadian hands.
I want to talk quickly about the 1990s. So we did have a similar period where foreigns exited Western Canada, BP, Amoco, Texaco, Marathon, and others, and they sold their project at low prices to Canadians. That actually was the roots of some of the companies we know today, including CNRL. So there is history to show that this can be positive over time.
Right. Yeah, and that's where some of our biggest independents sort of really germinated and became the companies they are today.
I want to quickly talk about Alberta natural gas prices. We don't talk about AECO price all that much, but as we know, it's been weak and volatile. But I want to talk about what happened here in May, because it's a great example of how just a little bit of production change can really be substantial in terms of the prices. So May, because of various reasons, there were some restrictions in the Montney production area. It's actually called upstream of James River area for maintenance work. On top of that, there were forest fires in the north in May. Peter, you were away last week, so you missed the smoke that we saw last week, especially last Friday.
I saw it on the news,
because of those forest fires. But they also resulted in restrictions in upstream production. So not all the gas from the wells could be produced because of some of the forest fires and maintenance work. So the interesting thing is, flows fell by about 10%. So production dropped by about 10% on the Nova system, which is sort of the gathering system owned by TransCanada. And that resulted in prices of about 230 Canadian per gigajoule. Those are some of the strongest prices we've seen in the last few years.
Okay, so help me out. You got 10% drop in production on 16 billion cubic feet a day or something
like that. Well, it was more on the Nova system, which is closer to 10 or 11 BCF. So it's about a BCF per day of lost production.
So 10% dropping and the price jumps by 100%, right? It goes from like $1.30.
We were averaging close to a dollar probably before that. Yeah, so we more than doubled.
More than doubled the price. So it just shows you how sensitive volume production at the margin and how it gets amplified into price movement.
And the crazy part is when the restrictions were removed, the price fell to like 30 cents at one point.
Yeah.
And so it's been sort of near the dollar level on average. So I know there's lots of talk about how we can fix our natural gas markets, but it's just an interesting real life experiment how just a little bit less production can be so meaningful for price.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, there's so many complications in terms of the gas markets and, you know, some people calling for curtailments, et cetera, et cetera. It's too much right now for our show today, but I think that ultimately, you're going to have to see the natural gas production volumes curtail themselves in terms of a market response, because a dollar a GJ or less is just not realistic. Mm-hmm.
But as we've talked before, that you'd think that would have happened already after almost a year and a half of these kind of prices. But the dynamics of certain producers not seeing that price, as well as these gases that come with liquids, has meant that the production remains stable. Right. And I expect actually production won't curtail this year based on the guidance of public companies.
No, not this year. So the only other solution, just to wrap up this section, is obviously the LNG. Just a gigantic leap in our ability to take it away.
Yes, that's definitely the solution, but unfortunately, that's still many years away.
Yeah, and so we're going to see volatile prices until such time as more takeaway comes in.
Okay, let's talk about...
Oil price?
Oil price, yes. Surprising fall in oil price. So it was about a month ago when we talked about oil price on our podcast, and that was after the United States had announced their goal of reducing Iranian exports to zero, and that drove price above $60 for a while. And we argued that the market looked well supplied, and so though, despite the fact that those barrels were coming off the market, we weren't expecting prices to really run up too far, and we talked about demand looking good at the time. Now prices tumbled since, dropped about $10 just in the last week.
Yeah,
now
it was
just
fast.
Above 50 now.
Yeah, it's pretty big. And but is it surprising? I mean, you said it was surprising. I mean, you went to the Permian, you saw what was going on. We did a podcast on that, saying, you know, there looks like there's a lot more to come. We talked about the Iranian situation and said, you know, if that ever changes, it's going to be problematic. And we have done a podcast on the economics, the world economy, and if it turns into recessionary flavor, then the price is going to weaken.
Right. We've talked about that.
So, you know, we do have a confluence of issues here that the market all of a sudden says, wow, now it's going the other way in terms of potential for demand, given the Trump trade war stuff, which we'll talk about in a second, the potential that the Iranian sanctions may not be as effective, and the third issue, which is the growth in the U.S. and the Permian.
Yeah, concerns that the supply may be growing more because of these large inventory builds. Let's start with Donald Trump. You know, he's the wild card in predicting oil prices these days. But, you know, his trade war has escalated. And that is, I think, what's spooking the market primarily right now, as well as the inventory builds. So that's what's changed, I think, in the last few weeks. May 10th, he announced that he's going to increase the tariffs on some Chinese goods by 25% with a threat to have 25% fee on all Chinese imports by July. And of course, China announced some counter tariffs as well as part of that. Now, the OECD, which estimates economic growth around the world, came out and said, based on Trump's threat for July, they would expect both China and U.S. economy would be about 0.75% less economic growth than the current outlook. So that's actually not too bad. We did some math on that. That would mean that oil demand globally probably still is above a million barrels a day growth over the year. And the outlook right now is about 1.3. So, you know, there's still strong demand.
There's strong demand. Yeah. And, you know, we've said on the show before that historically anything over a million barrels per day per year, you're in healthy demand territory for this business. If you drop below a million, then you're talking surpluses, definitely. But, you know, 1.3 to 1, that's still pretty a dramatic drop in a short period of time.
Yeah, no, it's true.
Like 300,000 barrels a day. We talked about natural gas earlier and how things at the margin can move price. Well, there you go. Right. I mean, if there's that expectation, we don't know if it's going to be a million, But the economic pundits like the OECD, which by the way are the, I think it's 28 countries in the wealthiest club, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD. So they monitor the world economy. They, along with the World Bank, the IMF, all these agencies are basically coming out and very cautionary right now, saying that, all this trade war stuff, we could see slowdown.
And you know, we all know that most of these economic agencies have not been very good at actually predicting when recessions happen and their impact. No. So there's that fear that it'll be larger. And people, for instance, are watching these economic indicators, especially around China. So the IEA reported that in the first quarter, Chinese oil demand was much less than it anticipated. Now they're saying, oh, it's going to catch up for the rest of the year because the Chinese have put all the stimulus in place. So we're not too worried about it. But that's kind of a weak data point. There's things like passenger auto sales in China, which are down quite a bit this year, although there's a lot of noise in the data. Mm-hmm. They have industrial production year on year, which actually is not too far off what it's been the last 3-4 years. But there was a little move down in the latest data point and got people nervous. Consumer confidence actually is still good in China.
Yeah, but I think just again want to get back to that point where small changes in physical hard numbers like natural gas, we just talked about a few minutes ago, or perceptions amplify into big changes in price at the margin.
Yeah.
That's what's going on.
Yeah. Well, and you know, one thing that you can see that really amplifies that in the oil markets is the futures market. So I want to talk about these money managers. These are people in the oil markets that aim to profit by gambling on the future price of oil. And you can find out how many contracts are out there where people are betting that price will go up versus people betting that price will go down. And you've seen over the last week and a half, this huge drop in the amount of people betting that the price will go up. So people saying, you know, I had all these future contracts that we're assuming it goes higher. I'm not thinking that's true anymore. I'm getting out of these deals.
So this is like the Vegas, you know, you're betting on all sorts of different things, you know, the handicapping, basically what you think your expectations are.
Yeah. And you've just seen this big drop in these long contracts. And so what this does is it amplifies what's going on, right? So, you know, because this sort of really influences the spot price and the futures price, you get wild changes and volatility that you wouldn't get, you know, if you didn't have this influence.
So I'm looking at this chart in front of us and it looks like the bears are coming out for sure.
Right. And so, you know, because we have poor visibility on some of the fundamentals, like uncertainty about China and the economy, and then we'll talk about the U.S. supply growth still. I kind of jumped ahead. Mm-hmm. These market speculators are going to amplify even the slightest change in expectation. So I think this is what we've seen. There's been a change in the expectation for the economy and supply, and they amplify that in terms of the price reaction. So it could go the other way too on us.
If we start
to get some positive headlines around the economy or around supply, as in less supply, you could see it move up pretty quickly
so
too.
So these are expectations and basically conjectures. What about the real hard data today about what's going on with supply growth?
All right. So on the supply side, we still have the outlook for Saudi and OPEC can offset any losses from Iran. And so that hasn't changed. Right now, it looks like Iran may only be down about 500,000 barrels. So they were exporting around 1 million. And, you know, they don't have the official numbers in yet, but people do things like count the tankers that are leaving Iran.
Yeah,
and they think that probably they're still exporting about 500,000 barrels a day.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing is that, you know, there's the expectation with the Trump administration tightening the sanctions that Iran was going to go to zero or something, and the market got excited and the price of oil nearly touched $70.
But
now looking like, okay, it's not as severe as it looks in terms of the sanctions.
So we've got a little more supply there.
Paired against the potential expectations of demand weakening, and that's causing these price weaknesses.
And then let's add the outlook for U.S. supply. So U.S. production, the view is that it's going to be about 1.1 or 1.2 million barrels a day of growth this year, compared with 1.6 million barrels a day in 2018. So quite a haircut in terms of U.S. growth. However, the U.S. stockpiles of crude keep growing. The last month, we've averaged about 4 million barrels of gain each week and 6.8 million last week. That's a huge gain, especially as refinery utilization is increasing as it always does this time of year. And we generally see crude stocks fall this time of year, but they're gaining. And so that's getting people worried that maybe U.S. supply growth is much higher than what is being anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would just say that U.S. tight oil in general, if I look back in the last 5 years and I look at people's forecasts at the beginning of the year, almost every single year, the supply growth has surpassed what people thought.
Yeah. I mean, this is just a rerun in many ways of the shale gas situation circa, I don't know, 2009, where, you know, every year, year after year, that just keeps growing, right?
It keeps surpassing people's expectations.
You know, this is the technology keeps getting better. The productivity, contrary to popular belief, keeps going up. You went and visited it on the ground and you saw what was going on. So, you know, the investment also that's going into the Permian with the Chevrons and the Exxons and the Conocos and others, this is the place where the money's going, and not surprisingly, the production's going up.
Mm-hmm. Now, I did look at what is the average amount of rigs operating on oil in the U.S. first 5 months of this year to last year, because there's all this talk about, you know, capital discipline and not as much money going in. There's been actually almost the same on average number of rigs operating. Plus, we have a bunch of DUCs. We know that. That's those drilled but uncompleted wells that can add supply. Now, you could argue that we need more drilling to go on this year, because as you get higher and higher production rates, the declines are actually larger too. So maybe the, you know, same number of rigs operating this year does not mean the same production growth. But anyway, well, there's been a fair amount of investment.
The numbers are proving otherwise. The storage tanks in the U.S. continue to rise. I mean, the storage data looks good. But, that all sounds exceedingly bearish. But let's just talk about, there is a floor below which the price of oil really can't sustain below much. What do you think that is?
Well, we've talked about it before. I think it's somewhere between $40 and $45. We saw it 2016 when we averaged $42 that even the Saudis couldn't handle it. So I do believe there's a floor, and it doesn't last long below that. And Saudi still seems to be in the business of cutting production. Now, there's this big OPEC meeting that was coming up in June that's been delayed into July. And so some people are a little worried that there's some changing going on there. But in general, they've been signaling that they are still in the business of cutting their production. So if we did have softer demand, they probably would cut. So I don't think it would stay down there for
a
year.
Yeah, but I don't think there's any mood to cut below a certain point. Like if you take 200,000-300,000 barrels off the demand side and the Permian grows by several hundred thousand, like nobody's going to cut between 500,000 and a million. It's just not going to happen.
Well, that's the big question.
But I think that the price definitely could slide further. But as the Saudi minister said, I think it was actually even this morning, that there's no investment that's going to happen below $60. And when you don't invest, then you start to see the results. If it goes below 50, the U.S. rig count will go lower.
Yeah, we saw that in 16.
Yeah, and that's very much a just-in-time delivery system down there. When the rigs go home, you do see the declines kick in and the production starts to peel back. So if you actually look at the trading patterns for oil over the course of the last 2-3 years, you know, post the real tight oil revolution, we'll call it, we find that 90% of the time, the price of oil trades between, what was it, 45 and 70, somewhere in there.
Yep.
So that's your 90%. And 2/3 of the time, it's between 50 and 60. And I think that's probably the long-term price range that one can expect. As a producer, you have to be able to weather a storm for a few months, potentially below those ranges. But 50 to 60 is the number. I think that the bearish sentiment is not really welcomed for the industry at this time. But having said that, you know, the North American oil and gas industry has been innovating quite aggressively over the last few years, has actually been adjusting to that 50 to 60 range. So for those that are already doing it, I don't think that there's much to worry about. And, you know, more concern is really the outcome of all this regulatory and policy uncertainty that we talked about earlier in the program. That's got to get really resolved as we move further.
Good. All right. Well, it's been a great discussion today.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us. If you like this podcast, please rate us on your app and tell someone else about us.
Great. Thanks.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.